Okay, I want to start by briefly flagging in broad terms the work program that's keeping ministers busy at the moment. And amongst the new sound system we obviously have. Over the coming weeks, we'll be working on the budget, and on Thursday, of course, Finance Minister Bill English will issue the government's budget policy statement for 2012. You will be advised about arrangements for the release of the budget policy statement in the next few days. This is really going well today. Okay, fantastic. It will confirm the government's clear economic plan for the next 3 years, including return to budget surplus and repaying debt. Within that plan, we set our main priorities for this term, which are responsibly managing the government's finances, building a more productive and competitive economy, delivering better public services within tight financial constraints, and of course rebuilding Christchurch. As the budget policy statement will show, budget 2012 will be about sticking to that plan. I want to add that the plan also includes such things as welfare reform and advancing the mixed ownership model to help fund more essential infrastructure like 21st century schools. We'll also show that the government is on track to post a surplus in 2014-15, as I said in my speech last month. That's now predicted to be between $300 and $500 million. Given events in Europe and the weakened outlook for global growth, the surplus is understandably smaller than was forecast in the pre-election update last October. Despite these global events, New Zealand's outlook remains positive. Our terms of trade are expected to remain high. Our largest trading partners are among the strongest performing economies in the world, and the rebuilding of Christchurch will provide impetus to the economy in coming years. But we do need to stick to our economic programme, and that's what Budget 2012 will be all about. As you know, the Electoral Commission has launched a review of the MMP system today. The review will consider a number of issues related to MMP, but Māori representation and the number of MPs are not part of the review. The Electoral Commission will report back to the government by the 31st of October with recommendations on whether or not changes to MMP are needed. Any recommendations would need to be considered by Cabinet. In terms of my activity this week, I have caucus and question time tomorrow. I'm in Wellington on Wednesday as well, Christchurch on Thursday, and Southland on Thursday night and Friday. In the House this week, we'll be continuing with the address and reply debate. Maiden speeches will also be concluded by this week. On Thursday, we'll have the first instance of extended sitting hours under Standing Order 54. We will be doing some treaty settlement bills and statutes amendment bills number 2 and number 3.
Just around that public service stuff that you mentioned in there, how widespread is it going to be? Obviously, lots of job losses again for the next 3 years, like we saw in the first 3 years.
Well, I think there's a number of component parts that are worth considering. One is you will see further mergers within the state sector. Secondly, you'll see a sharing of resources where that makes sense to do so, in areas like back office and HR. There'll be a renewed or an increased focus of making sure that the way people deal with the government is more efficient. So we want people to be able to deal with the government over a smartphone. We live in a world where the internet and 21st century technology is available, and where people get frustrated when they have to give their personal information to government, to multiple different government departments. So that's a big area of work. And the other thing is we're looking at the sorts of services that government provides, all the way from education through to policing, and asking some hard questions about what it is we expect from those services. And I think you'll see some fairly clear expectations from us of where we're going. So it's quite a revamp of the public service, and I think we'll deliver better results from
the
service.
When there's mergers, are you talking quite widespread mergers?
Look, I don't want to go into that today. I mean, what I'd say to you is that there won't be mergers for the sake of mergers. But they need to make sense. I mean, we've had plenty of those examples where governments either want to put together entities and then subsequent governments break them up. But as you saw with the Ministry for Primary Industries, I think it was a good example of where we put together logical industries like forestry with fisheries, with agriculture, and where there's obvious synergy. So that's what we're looking for. But also in that back office support area, there's a lot of people involved in administration of government services where we think we can share those services.
So do you have an idea of reducing the cap even further than if you had more of these hubs, if you like?
We might be able to, but we'll need to see that before the time.
You expect quite a few more job losses there?
Well, again, over time you'll need to see that, but we expect to make no apology for wanting greater efficiency out of government, central government agencies.
So that's going to be flagged quite clearly on Thursday, or is that something that's going to be more... firmly identified down the track.
Slightly down the track. We haven't exactly set the date for when I'll give the speech in relation to Better Public Services, but that will be within the next, I think it's sort of 3 weeks or so.
In budget 2011, you had health and education, you had increases in spending for those, and everything else was stagnant or cuts. Is that likely to be the same in this budget? And are you going to flag that on Thursday?
Well, we have $800 million as new budget spending component. That's obviously
so where's it going to go?
Well, you can guess, like I can guess, that the vast bulk of that will be eaten up in health and education. That's just enough to essentially deliver both population and inflation adjustments. So it's going to be tight for both of those big spending ministries, let alone anybody else. So that shows you why the government needs to save money. If we're going to pay for the general wage rounds that we get and the other cost pressures, then we need to find savings in other places.
Are you committed to $800 million or not?
We're committed to $800 million this year, and next year $1.2 billion. The year after, look, it could be lower if we really saw a catastrophic meltdown in Europe. But at the moment, that seems to have stabilised a little bit in the last week or so.
Both the Treasury and the Ministry of Education have suggested that you could save money by having slightly larger class sizes. Is that something that's being seriously considered?
Well, the government hasn't had an opportunity to consider that. We've obviously seen that recommendation in the BIM. I mean, I guess what I would still say is the obvious cost pressure is in Auckland. That's where we see the real pressure on the schooling system. And to a certain degree, you know, there's a very strong research focus which suggests that class sizes aren't the biggest factor in determining the outcome for your children. It's the quality of teachers and principals that are in front of those kids. So we have some sympathy for that argument, but obviously it will depend on, you know, how far you took that and what that all means. So it's also part of the collective agreement with the teachers' unions. So it's not something that the government can just change easily. We need to negotiate that.
Prime Minister, has Cabinet had a chance to consider David Clark's bill on Monday ising public holidays?
Yeah, so I asked for some advice from the Department of Labour. I got that advice over the weekend. In broad terms, it says a few things. So first, it says the first time this issue will present itself again is 2015. It's not until 2021 that both Anzac Day and Waitangi Day fall over the weekend. The cost for an individual day, if we were to Mondayise them, is $200 million to the economy. So about $400 million falls over the weekend. It's both of them. It's likely to affect 1.4 million New Zealanders, and the recommendation from the Department of Labour is to not Mondayise those holidays. From the caucus's point of view, or from the Cabinet's point of view, we're taking it to caucus tomorrow. We'll have some discussions with them over the next few weeks. I would like to drill into the data a little bit more because it's quite, I think, top line, reasonably superficial, but that's our initial thinking.
What if 200 million happens anyway?
Yeah, so that's one of the arguments that, yeah, effectively they pay it all the rest of the time except for the times where it falls over the weekend. We understand that. And as I say to you, that's one of the reasons we need to actually have a look at it, because is it just a reduction in productivity, or is it actually a physical cash payment? If you're on salary, it's obviously productivity. If it's wages, it's a different story. We're also on the reasonably generous end in terms of the number of holidays that we have compared to a number of countries around the world, but I've asked for some comparative advice.
So how will caucus decide what questions of the discussion, or, you know, will you lead that?
Yeah, well, we'll give them an update on the advice we have. I think we'll tell them we're going to go away and seek some more advice and drill down a bit more into it. The advice the Leader of the House gave me is that the bill won't be onto the floor of Parliament for about 6 weeks, so we've got a bit of time to work our way through it. We'll also be interesting to see how the votes fall within Parliament. I imagine a lot of political parties will vote for it in its current form for an introduction. I don't know what ACT and United do. ACT, my guess, would vote against it. United, I'm not sure.
So Cabinet's not making a recommendation to caucus then?
No. The initial stage is going to take the temperature of caucus.
So it could be that United Future has the casting vote on this. If national votes against it, you may not be able to stop this.
That's a possibility, but I mean, I think we want to go through those issues first anyway.
Where does the generosity of our holidays come from? I don't think I've read that we're down the ungenerous end.
Yeah, well, they haven't provided me that comparative table. I want to have a look at that. But some of the things I saw was that we're at the higher end. We're not compared to Australia, but I think everywhere else apparently we are. But I'll come back with more advice.
When you say it affects 1.4 million people, that's 1.4 million people who miss out on those.
Yeah,
that's so
right.
That 1.4 million people would get...
They would get an additional two holidays effectively at certain times in 2020, for instance, 2021, they'd get two additional holidays.
So
Just going back to the state sector reforms, just one question.
Yeah.
Are you confident, if you're moving to smartphones and internet connections with a lot of clients who deal with state agencies, are you confident that you're not actually making it more difficult for the very people who use it most often? I'm thinking if people are down the fore and they may not have smartphones and internet access.
Yeah. Well, obviously it's about optionality, so making sure that if you do have available that technology available and you want to use it, you can. I mean, there'll be certainly be some people that aren't. I mean, our bigger issue really there is the cost of that technology and the security of that technology. So they've been the two things that we've been asking ministers to test out. And we had some discussions with people like Google when we were in the US last year, who are starting to provide this capability on a bigger scale to other governments around the world.
As you're going directly into frontline services, and having you actually cut frontline services or frontline positions, when you had talked about backroom cuts?
No, in my view, we haven't done that. We've always preserved, in fact, often increased frontline services. But if we, for instance, cut the number of people because we can have a shared service in HR or accounting or other administrative functions, then that, I think, makes sense.
But like IRD offices in the regions and that sort of thing, they've been closed down. So that's a service that someone can't walk into now that could have 3 years ago.
Yeah, again, a number of reasons specific to IRD. They had a build-up of staff for a variety of reasons in the regions, but more often than not, it's because there is the belief that we can provide better frontline services by amalgamating those services. And you sometimes see it in health as well, those debates are percolating around at the moment. I mean, modern technology allows people to interact with us, or even just using phone-based services. It really doesn't matter, you know, that there's a strict frontage there. So we often preserve them if we can, But on the data, I think IRD have had more people contacting them by the phone.
But isn't it disingenuous then to just be talking about back order, you know, HR and that sort of thing, when actually those frontline services are changing?
Well, they may change, but if they change, they'll change for the better. So they're about greater efficiency. So we can't stand in the way of technology, nor would we want to. I mean, I think the main point to take away from all this is that in a discussion about public services, it's a much broader discussion than simply saying it's about, you know, some redundancies or one or two mergers. It's about saying, how do we as the government deliver for New Zealanders both better value for money, better services and better outcomes?
So would you contract some of the services out to the private sector then?
It's possible. That's been an issue, and the Minister of Finance has been looking at. We've been doing quite a bit around shared procurement. That's sort of slightly adjunct to all of this, but again, that's seen some significant savings coming through.
Isn't it arguable to some people that an online or telephone service is better? You know, some people actually prefer to go in and talk to somebody directly and face to face rather than going through a computer system and pushing buttons and, you know, maybe taking some time and not being able to have that individual service.
At an individual level, there may always be a person that says, look, I would much prefer to walk in and talk to somebody behind the counter. But I mean, that's the same argument that could have been put up when FPOS machines were brought in or Air New Zealand brought online checking. In fact, New Zealanders have been early adopters and high users of technology, and for the most part, delivered better outcomes for them. So I think we're talking about the government, which supplies services to virtually every New Zealander, and en masse, that service being better. For the most part, I think if people could apply for their passport over a smartphone or, you know, interact with the government on all of those different issues via technology efficiently, putting their data into the government sort of depository in one place without having to repeat it all the time. There's great efficiencies that can come from that, and actually the government can probably do better planning.
You get rid of the whole public service, couldn't you, in time? That sort of scenario?
No, but it's about greater efficiency. I mean, we're living in a world where, you know, kids are using iPads and have smartphones, and that's the modern generation, and they want to deal with us in an efficient way. They actually don't want to walk in, for the most part, and actually be in a very long queue and be waiting a long time to get a bus.
You could get rid of thousands of people.
Well, it'll take a big investment in technology. I mean, you've got to remember, we're driving this from a process of saying, how do we deliver better results, how do we deliver efficiency and better value for money, and how do we deliver the best outcome for New Zealanders? And then what the rest of that, what that the makeup then of the public service looks like, is what drives that, rather than saying we just want a few less people. And the chief executives, I might add, have been in part of this process for quite some time now, working with DPMC, State Services Commissioner, and Treasury. The central agencies have been very heavily involved, and they're very supportive of what we're doing.
Are you proposing a change to the accountability procedures for chief executives?
Look, they are issues that may be considered, but I'm not in a position to go into that today.
So it could be as drastic as that, that who they report to could change?
I wouldn't want to go into that today, and I don't want to overly speculate on that, except to say that the advice we've had has been quite wide-ranging. It's fair to say that the government, for a variety of reasons, will reject some of the advice.
So if this change is so transformational, why didn't you make it transparent in the way, you know, the options? Why haven't you made those transparent in the way that you did with the welfare working group and the savings group, so that there was more of a collaboration around it?
Well, I think there has been quite a lot of collaboration so far with the agencies themselves. Once we've had that information in terms of better public services, we've had quite extensive discussions with the chief executives. And in the end, the purpose of this speech in 2 or 3 weeks' time is to socialise these issues with New Zealanders. But I think, you know, from their point of view, I suspect what most New Zealanders want is to know that the service they want to get from the government, whether it's everything from education to police right through to applying for a passport or filling out their IRD form, is more efficient. And in the end of the day, they just want us to get on with it and do it.
The state sector unions haven't been part of that collaboration, have they?
I can't answer that question, I don't know. But they certainly will be informed at the time.
And are there any constitutional issues with these plan changes to?
Not in terms of any advice I've seen, no. I don't think so.
Prime Minister, in terms of the discussions with Google, what sort of services are you talking about here, and what countries have adopted them?
Oh, just the technological capabilities. I mean, the US, for start, are supplying quite a lot of data.
They're selling services to the New Zealand, to the US government for social security and so forth.
Well, the programming capability, yeah, they're building a lot of that, and a number of other countries as well are working with.
So, can you
be allowed to charge the likes of the GST? Be allowed to charge a GST or something like that?
Well, I think what the discussion from Len Brown today does, at least, is focus the mind for Aucklanders about how expensive it will be to fund some of the projects that are being proposed. I think it needs to be recognised that the government's already spending an enormous amount of money in Auckland and has made a lot of gains with its electrification right through to the largest roading project in New Zealand's history in the form of Waterview. It's the government who reserves the right about whether personal taxes, GST and all of those things are increased. And the only thing I would say is, as a government, we've been very reluctant to put additional cost on homeowners and taxpayers. So, you know, there's a long way to go before we would necessarily agree to any of this, but we recognise, you know, there's some infrastructure demands in there. This will be a healthy debate, at least, about how much these things cost. But, you know, a massive increase in taxes right across the board, I can't see that being acceptable to too many people.
Do you think that asset sales should have been amongst the options canvassed in this discussion document?
Well, I think Michael Barnett makes the right point, that if you want to consider how you might pay for the infrastructure, you need to think about all the options on the table. And that's really what the government does when it has its mixed ownership model. I mean, not all New Zealanders will agree with us, but we have up front said, here's our mix of what we think is the right mix of infrastructure and assets that we hold. Auckland probably should do the same.
Regarding our mixed ownership model, which valuations is the government using to assess the value of the nominated SOEs? Because there's huge variance between the SOEs themselves and the estimates from Common.
Yeah, and that's one of the issues around why you've got to be extremely careful when you start running around saying they're making this return on investment or that return on investment. As you know, Solomon Energy in 1 year went from a valuation that was about $500 million to $2.5 billion. I don't think anyone seriously thinks it had a value pickup of you know, 4 times or 5 times in 1 year. I mean, in the end, it's the value that we think that we can get if we undertake the IPO process. And the advice we've had then is we're likely to be at the higher end of that $5 to $7 billion range, and $6.2 billion.
So that's right. Common with the SOEs and the boards of directors.
Well, it doesn't matter, does it? I mean, because they're all subjective. What matters is how much we can sell the shares for. And on the advice we've had from those who are closest to the valuation, the bankers, we think it's at the top end of our range.
You have said that that's going to actually lead to those companies performing better with new capital coming in, but how's that the case given that the money you get from the sales is going to be spent elsewhere, it's not going to be invested in the SOEs?
Correct. That then leaves those companies, I think, in a position to potentially undertake other activity. So, for instance, in the case of Mighty River, we know that they've got very good geothermal capability they want to take offshore. Now, yes, they'd have to fund that capital investment, but at least the government wouldn't have to fund all of it. And at the moment, those companies are generally been retaining quite a lot of income on their balance sheet anyway, so there's some capability there. So, I mean, our view is they are likely to engage in greater and better activities when they've got a range of different shareholders and analysis taking place.
Is it a possibility, though, that under that mixed ownership model, that those companies could expand offshore, but with a subsidiary which is effectively 100% privately owned? Private investors basically carry the cost of that, but they also...
I think that's sort of hypothetical and too advanced. I haven't seen any proposals for that. I mean, there's nothing stopping, theoretically, an SOE having a subsidiary or a mixed ownership model company having a subsidiary. But by definition, if it's a subsidiary, then the parent company has a shareholding or interest in that company, and so therefore there's an implied government ownership of that.
Because you're saying the government doesn't want to invest at all in those sorts of activities, doesn't it? Doesn't have the money to.
Well, we don't have the money to, but it's also not just straight the money. There's other factors at play here. I mean, my view is that ministers will always act very conservatively. That's probably in their best interest, but not necessarily in the best interest of the development of those companies. And that was the view that Trevor Mallard held when he was Minister of SOEs. I mean, he's talked about exactly what you're talking about, subsidiary companies potentially even being floated in their own right, owned by, in that case, SOEs. So he himself saw that value there.
What would be the implication for the partial flow process if an SOE has been...
Do you think we should have any changes to the electorate seat threshold?
Look, all I can say is that review's now going to take place. New Zealanders will have a chance to have their input into the process. When that comes back, we will obviously, as a political party and as ministers, go away and consider those recommendations and see which ones we're supportive of. I don't really want to dissect those today. I think there's a number of options on the table, but I think it's better for New Zealanders to express their views of what they think are the strengths and potential weaknesses of MMP as we currently have it.
Instead of having all those
whiskey
cups of tea, though.
That would be nice.
What would be the implication for the partial float process if an SOE has deemed its commercial value to have fallen?
Oh, that's not relevant. What is relevant is how much we can sell the shares for, and that is based on what the investment bankers think at the time in terms of the value of the company. As I say, the valuations you're talking about, there's a number of them, and they're subjective. So the test for the government is, can it achieve its targets in terms of release of capital and fair value? And the advice we've had so far is yes, and at the higher end.
Have you had any legal advice on whether the court actions which are taking place over the SOE Section 9 are likely to delay the sale?
Look, I haven't seen any advice on that. You'd have to ask the Tribunal, so he might have seen it. Some might have seen it, but I mean, on the wider issue, my understanding is the hui are going well, the consultation is going well. I remain ever confident in the elegant solution will be found.
Do you have any advice about the flu alert at Auckland Airport and any wider concerns about those passengers?
The Minister of Health gave me an update before I came down here to say that they are confident that it's just a seasonal flu, and it's a flu that's, I think, been prevalent in New Zealand, so that says a new strain, and I think the kids involved have been sent off to their homestays. So we're not concerned it's introducing a new virus.
So they were Japanese?
I think they were Japanese. They're coming to the homestays.
Some of the passengers said that the process was pretty chaotic. There was a bit of a lack of communication. Have you had any advice at all on how it was carried out or handled?
When they landed in Auckland? Look, I haven't had an update on that yet, but I think what would be fair to say is that if we thought there was a major potential outbreak of some other strain of fever, then obviously you expect the authorities to act cautiously, and by the sounds of things, they acted cautiously until they knew exactly what they were dealing with.
So you think the response was proportionate to the potential?
Well, I haven't had a full update on that, but you know, initially I would certainly be backing them to act cautiously, and it sounds like they have, but in short and fullness of time, we'll have a look.
Are you happy, though, that a large group of young people got on board a plane? Presumably they would have had flu symptoms before they got on board.
Well, one assumes that it wasn't, you know, we don't do the, you know, you remember when we had swine flu and people were going through those heat sensors and being tested, that doesn't happen now. So, you know, if you rock up to the airport and you have the sniffles, they probably still let you on board. I think, you know, at this point, nothing's changed there.
Did Cabinet have any further discussion today about governance issues in Christchurch?
No.
Do you share Gerry Brown's concern that you expressed last week about your ability to pay their share of the bill for the obstruction?
Well, I think he's right that Christchurch has to pay its fair share, but I think it's also right to say the government intends to act very fairly and, frankly, very fully in terms of restoring infrastructure in Christchurch. We're not expecting Christchurch ratepayers to pay twice. We recognise they pay for a lot of infrastructure which was destroyed beyond their control, and that was why $5.5 billion was allocated in Budget 2011. But, you know, there's, you know, the point from the Minister is that there's certain costs which rightfully fall on Christchurch ratepayers, and they should pay those costs.
And are they, to date, you know, showing enough willingness to come to the government, or are they putting their hand out a little too much?
I think there's been a feeling they've been coming, certainly been willing to come to the government and ask for the share. Whether the share is absolutely rightfully proportioned, that's a matter of debate.
Just one last question on the Monday, Isaac.
Yeah.
That report that you had from the Department of Labour, has that given you reason to have any concerns about voting for this, you know, the high cost of the economy?
Well, it's one further input into it. I mean, I think it's fair to say, you know, New Zealanders sure would prefer to have a holiday than not have one, so I can understand that issue. There has to be factored against costs for businesses and the economy overall. Let's get a bit more advice.
What's your personal preference?
So it's nice having a holiday, although I tend to work a lot of those Monday holidays anyway, but we'll see. I mean, yeah, there's certainly costs on the economy.
Just going back to the member round discussion document, yeah. As Tourism Minister, what's your feeling about a bed tax or an increase in the departure tax at Auckland International Airport?
I've had sort of similar advice from my own officials, not so much directly relating that, but looking at ways that we can increase the revenue for tourism, particularly for low rating bases. So you take a place like Experience, you know, Fox Glacier. They have about 1 million people going there, an incredibly small rating base, under 1,000 people. In fact, it might even be under 200, if you remember. And so the issue there is, how do you pay for some of that infrastructure? So they have been testing out ideas of how that might work. There's always been a few concerns about, you know, what is fair. I mean, the balancing act here is to make sure you're not turning people off coming to the country. And that's the issue. Any increase in tax, in the end, it's not just a free option. There are always implications of that. If you take more money out of the economy to pay for more infrastructure, that's less spending that happens somewhere else. So it's not just not a free option to say we're going to slug it to the Aucklanders, expect them to pay more, and expect no consequences. And for a lot of Aucklanders, it's an expensive place to live. They're not high-income families, and they're struggling anyway. So imagine they've been choking on their coolness this morning when they were reading about the 10 new taxes being proposed.
And what's your thinking on, how's things going with the negotiations with Sky City on the convention centre?
Progressing pretty well, but we haven't got a deal yet.
How likely do you think a deal will be struck?
I'm also extremely confident we'll get a deal, but it has to be one that stacks up in commercial terms, and we've made that clear to Sky City.
And Minister, I'm Christchurch. Just in very broad terms, people are starting to reflect now on a year since the big earthquake.
Yeah.
Are you disappointed in the rate of progress of rebuilding of Christchurch?
No. I mean, I actually think if you put it in the context of, this is the fourth largest insurance claim in the world since 1973. We've had massive seismic activity post the very big earthquakes in September of 2010, February 2011. And everyone can see the size of the challenge. So, look, I think tremendous progress is being made there. I think it's tough on the people of Christchurch, and it's frustrating. But I'm actually confident we are making progress, and Sarah has, you know, wide powers and significant opportunities to help that process.
Is the city ever going to be the city that it once was?
It'll be a completely different city. I mean, I think if you look at the CBD, and it's largely going to be demolished and will have to be rebuilt. So I think the look and feel of Christchurch will be significantly different, but it'll be an extremely livable 21st century city when it's rebuilt.
In Australia, the politicians are having a bit of fun beating up on the banks for increasing interest rates without an official rate increase. Would your government be the same? Have the same sort of stance as Gillard and Swan?
I think we thought banks were acting unfairly and rapaciously, but in my view, they're not doing that. In fact, the banks have been arguing with me that they're struggling to grow their corporate lending balance sheets, and they're actually keen to do that. So corporate credit hasn't actually been growing, and they need to grow their balance sheet. So I don't think they'll be looking to jack up interest rates anytime soon.
So they're
just looking for some decent projects. Thanks very much.